Your Second Amendment rights are under siege, but they will never, ever be under siege as long as I'm your president. All of us. Thank you. Thank you. All of us here today are united by the same timeless values. We believe that our liberty is a gift from our Creator and that no government can ever take it away. We believe in the rule of law.
President Trump speaking at the National Rifle Association convention in Dallas today. He's probably happy to have an excuse to be out of Washington, where the Stormy Daniels, Rudy Giuliani, Michael Cohen, hush money furor is not showing any signs of letting up. Also, the California Republican Party convention starts today in San Diego. One GOP Senate candidate who won't be speaking to the gathered faithful is neo-Nazi Patrick Little. He did well in a recent online poll, and that's gotten some press attention. The party is working hard to distance itself from him. Josh Barrow joins us now. He is senior editor at Business Insider and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
Great to see you in studio.
I know. It's great to be here.
All right. So Trump claims Giuliani is wrong when he said that Trump repaid Michael Cohen that $130,000 that Stormy Daniels was given. It's quite confusing to know where the truth lies here, because his earlier tweets yesterday appeared to confirm what Giuliani said. Today he's saying, no, Giuliani has his facts wrong.
We actually did a special episode of Left, Right, and Center this week with Ken White, who's a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor here in L.A. And one thing he was telling us basically is that when you look at these lawyers, both his and then also Michael Avenatti, the lawyer for Stormy Daniels, they're doing law and PR at the same time. Mm-hmm. So to understand their strategy, you have to think about them together. And I think, you know, the president wants Giuliani out there taking a more combative posture with regard to this investigation than the president has over the first year of it, with Ty Cobb, the lawyer in the White House, actually taking a fairly cooperative line with the investigators. And so he's got that PR message of combat out there. The problem is that your lawyer can end up saying things that undermine your position. I mean, for example, you have the president now in those tweets after Giuliani made his comments saying that Stormy Daniels' claim of an affair with him was false and extortionate. And the problem is, you know, the president's currently being sued for defamation by Stormy Daniels. And as Ken described to us, the defamation claim that she was making actually seemed fairly weak. The president said that, you know, the claim that she'd been threatened in a parking lot was a con job. The thing is that, you know, for something to be defamation, it has to be a factual claim. An opinion can't be libel
Right.
So the question is, are these factual claims? The president came out this week with this much more measured set of tweets saying that what Stormy Daniels had claimed about them having an affair was false. So that seems like, you know, they've handed her a stronger defamation claim. I expect pretty soon we'll see Michael Avenatti back in court adding this to that case. So the problem is, when you talk publicly, maybe you get a PR message out there, but you can also weaken your legal position.
So that particular legal position, but I guess what Giuliani was interested in was the campaign finance law violations, that side of it.
Right.
And so I guess he was trying to shore up that problem rather than the defamation problem.
But he weakened that position too, because the message from the president and Giuliani has been this was a purely personal expenditure. It had nothing to do with the campaign. And this is, you know, this is a fact question. It was an issue when John Edwards went on trial about payments to his mistress. The question is, are you paying your mistress for a purely private purpose, like you don't want your wife to hear about it, or for a public purpose, like you think the disclosure of it will hurt your political standing? And so Giuliani was on Fox and Friends saying that Michael Cohen did his job, because could you imagine if these claims had come out just a few weeks before the election? Now, that's a statement that makes it sound like it,
like
quite
it was
possibly
was an election-related payment.
An election-related payment.
Ah, okay. So where does this leave congressional Republicans? They haven't said a lot about this.
Well, I think they try to say as little about this as possible. You had these inquiries in Congress, and you still have them officially, looking into the Russia matters in the 2016 election. And they've backed off a little bit, partly, I think, because Republicans realized that investigating their own president was hurting them politically. It was unpopular in the party. But the other reason was that they would risk interfering with Robert Mueller's investigation. So they've been able to say, look, Robert Mueller's in first position. We're going to let him investigate. So I don't think you'll hear too much from members of Congress about this. And they've especially been saying as little as possible about Stormy Daniels, saying this is basically just a sex scandal. And obviously, you know, it is a sex scandal, but it has a number of these legal elements. And you've gotten this raid of Michael Cohen's office. And we will see what the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York is up to there, whether there's something that Michael Cohen will end up indicted for and whether it's related to the president or not.
Meanwhile, here in California, the Republican Party convention gets underway today in San Diego, and I guess they have to decide whether they're going to hold Trump close or at arm's distance as well. There are two candidates looking for the party's endorsement, John Cox and Travis Allen. I assume John Cox, because he's polling better, is going to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the parties are weaker now than they've been in decades, basically. So I question how much it matters who gets the party's endorsement. You see this also on the Democratic side, where you have a wide open field with a number of candidates. And I think voters look at this and they sort of make their own decisions without regard to what the party tells them what to do. So I think Democrats, they have an opportunity here to end up with two Democratic candidates in the general election, giving them 100% chance of winning it, maybe demoralizing Republican voters so they don't come out in November. And then that helps Democrats in congressional races. You would normally expect that, you know, Republicans in their weaker position would coalesce around one candidate, and that person would be able to pick up, say, whatever it is, 25-30% of the vote in the open primary, and that guarantees Republicans a slot on the general election ballot. But because Republicans have two significant candidates of their own, I think it's fairly likely that you'll end up, say, with Gavin Newsom and Antonio Villaraigosa in the general election, and whoever gets endorsed at this convention, you could end up with no Republican candidate on the ballot.
Although John Cox was polling second until just recently.
Yeah, I mean, the poll numbers have been very close together. So, you know, you get a few different polls, and with the margin of error, you know, people can move up and down just a couple of points, and that moves you from second to fourth. So it's quite possible that somebody will miss out on that general election ballot just a point or two behind whoever's in second place.
But you still think it's going to be the two top Democrats?
That's what I'd put my money on. I wouldn't bet my life on it.
Okay. Let's talk about this other strange story. Patrick Little, who calls himself a counter-Semitic candidate. According to SurveyUSA, this poll, he is number two behind Dianne Feinstein for the U.S. Senate race.
It's a testament to the weakness of the Republican Party in California, and particularly to their position in elections for federal office, for the Senate. You don't get somebody who would be credible, so you end up with a bunch of cranks and weirdos, and you can end up with a candidate like this. My guess is that, you know, Kevin DeLeon has a fair amount of progressive energy, and as he gets his name ID up, that he will likely be able to get on that November ballot rather than this Little person. But if he does make it into the November ballot with Dianne Feinstein simply by having an R next to his name, then she will have dodged a bullet and be very glad and will roll on to a very easy victory.
But does it surprise you that he's polling second and DeLeon is not? I mean, is not a newcomer to California politics.
California still has quite a lot of Republicans, even though it is a strongly Democratic state. And so you have a lot of voters who will basically, they'll go into the ballot box and they'll pick the person with an R next to their name. It doesn't say counter-Semite on the ballot next to him, or at least I assume that's not in his ballot statement. I know in California, you're allowed to be a little wordier on the ballot than in most states. I wouldn't take this as an endorsement of rank-and-file Republican voters of whatever we're saying counter-Semitism is. I think it's just a reflection that, you know,
he's a neo-Nazi. Let's just put it
out
there.
Yeah. But he's also a warm body, and a lot of people will vote for a warm body with the party ID label for their party next to it. I mean, the other thing is, I think, you know, people have very little information about this guy. They'll probably have somewhat more by the time they're voting. So hopefully this will hurt his poll standing once people find out he's a neo-Nazi.
Okay, finally, let's talk about the economy. For the first time in a very long time, the unemployment rate has a 3 in front of it. It's at 3.9%. And is that good news?
Yes.
Sure sounds like it's great news.
The job situation is good right now. Unemployment has, you know, it's taken a long time coming out of the Great Recession, but unemployment is low again. And we're also starting to see wage growth pick up somewhat. That's a good sign that the tighter labor market is actually giving workers a little bit more power to bargain for higher wages.
But it doesn't count those who have stopped looking for work. So how many people are actually employed?
Right. So we can look also at what's called the labor force participation rate, which is basically what fraction of the population is either working or trying to find a job. And that fell sharply during the recession. And it hasn't really come back. It's basically been flat for the last few years. And that's what we continue to see in this report. It ticked down very slightly. The fact that it's flat has actually reflected a little bit of strength, but not as much strength as I would like to see to overcome the really significant loss of participation that we had from the 08 crash.
So how many people who are able to work are not working for various reasons? Do we know that number?
Able to work is a surprisingly difficult thing to define. I mean,
of working age. Let's just say that.
Well, so approximately 62% of Americans over the age of 16 are in the labor force, which is to say they're working or looking for work. But it's hard to say, you know, which of those people should be working. Obviously, you know, 17-year-olds, they're in school. We don't say that's a sign of a problem with the economy. We say they're getting educated. That's good. As you've seen increases in higher education, you have declines in the number of people in their early 20s who work, and that might also be fine. And then you also have had increases in labor force participation by people on the high end of the age spectrum. And so you can tell good or bad stories about that. You can identify a lot of people who could work under a different set of circumstances. To say in each individual case, should we want this person working? I think it's somewhat subjective.
Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, which you can hear tonight at 7 o'clock. Josh, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Coming up, is it a good thing that Democratic officials are pressuring progressive candidates to drop out of some congressional races? We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are lots of Democrats running for House seats this year, and that embarrassment of riches for the Democrats is proving to be a problem for them, too, because more candidates in primaries means a diluted Democratic vote and Republicans possibly winning. So that's why there's been a not-so-secret plan by one arm of the party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, to pressure Democratic candidates to drop out. The latest to do so is Rachel Payne, who is running to replace Orange County Republican Dana Rohrabacher. She did not say if the DCCC was involved in her decision, but it has been involved in another competitive district in Colorado. A secret recording made by one of the progressive candidates in that race revealed Maryland Congressman Steny Hoyer urging him to drop out.
So your position is a decision was made, you know, very early on before voters had a say. That's fine because that's the DCCC knows better than the voters of the 6th Congressional District, and we should line up behind that candidate.
That's certainly the consequence of our decision.
Well, that recording caused a lot of anger among progressives, but according to one politics expert, they need to get over it. Elaine K. Mark is the author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. She argued in a recent New York Times op-ed that the DCCC should be getting involved in these races. And Elaine K. Mark joins me now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, okay, let me make the argument that the progressive candidate in that race made and others have made, and that is, why should the party apparatus weigh in before the voters have had a chance to do so?
Because the party leadership, in which this case Steny Hoyer is not just a congressman from Maryland, he's the second ranking Democrat in the House after Nancy Pelosi, and the party leadership has a job to do, and their job is to win the majority in the House or in the Senate. And in doing that job, they have a very cold eye, if you will, on these districts and on who's running, and they make a judgment as to who could best win the race in that district. The districts we are talking about here where they have intervened, they're not Berkeley, California. They're not Cambridge, Massachusetts. They are not liberal districts. In fact, they're swing districts, which means that you need a certain kind of candidate to be able to win those districts. And that's why they are intervening in some of these races.
Well, it can backfire, as we saw in Texas recently, the party's decision to release Oppo Research on one of its own candidates, Laura Moser. That just strengthened her candidacy. She ended up in the primary runoff.
Yeah, that was a sort of ham-handed intervention, which I think they all regret. Look, these guys aren't perfect, but what they do, and it is completely within their rights to do, is they try and influence who will be running in these primaries so that they can have the best chance of taking the seat. Look at California's situation right now. With the top two primary, if you have 10, 15 Democrats splitting up the vote, you could have a district that should be a Democratic district all of a sudden going Republican.
Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, is saying that the party should stay out of it. At least the DNC is staying neutral.
Well, the DNC is staying neutral, but remember, these are two slightly different bodies, right? The DNC's job is growing the party overall, and that means all wings of the party from the far left to the moderates. The DCCC's job is really quite specific. It is to take control of the House, because when you have control of the House, you can control the agenda. And therefore, progressive ideas can actually get out of committees and onto the floor of the House. And of course, when the Republicans control the House, that can't even happen.
Well, I guess the progressives would say, if you're not electing a progressive at all, how do those ideas get to the floor of the House?
The difference between a quote progressive candidate in a Democratic primary and a moderate candidate in a Democratic primary just isn't night and day, right? They are close on 90% of the issues, and either of them is far preferable, if you're a Democrat, to having a Republican win. So the question is, which Democrat has the better chance of winning? Because only by winning and controlling the House can you even begin to pursue a progressive agenda.
But this is raising the issue of what happened in the 2016 election between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. So Bernie Sanders was considered left of Clinton, and he was the progressive candidate, and yet he was popular in some not totally dark blue districts. And then it came out that the DNC was favoring Hillary Clinton. And is there a possibility that by, you know, the DCCC putting its heavy thumb on the scales here, that that's actually undermining public confidence in the whole Democratic process, and that would turn off voters, especially younger voters, millennial voters, who tend to vote, at least on the Democratic side, on the progressive side?
I doubt it, and the reason I doubt it is that if the Democrats take the House, people are going to look at this and they're going to say, oh, look, we were able to take the House because we were able to move districts into the Democratic column. What I think people lose is they lose that connection between elections and government. You can feel good and vote for the most progressive candidate in 20 congressional districts, but if they all lose, you still have a House of Representatives under a president that are pursuing an extreme right-wing agenda. You may have felt good, but you haven't moved, you haven't gotten anywhere in your own political wishes.
Right. But I guess what I'm wondering here is that this is for the short-term expediency of getting the House back. But in the longer run, are you alienating and angering a core group of supporters? And as the Republicans did when they tried to do the same thing, stir up such an anger that those voters then look to a candidate like Donald Trump?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that the difference between a progressive Democrat and a moderate Democrat just simply isn't that big. And a lot of times the interference is not on the basis of ideology. It's on the basis of who the DCCC thinks is the stronger of the candidates by virtue of background, by virtue of ability to raise money, all those factors in a district. I don't think this will turn off anybody.
Elaine K. Mark. She's the author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, thank you.
Thank you so much. And nice to talk to you, Madeline.
Coming up, we're going to have movie reviews, including the Overboard reboot and one starring Charlize Theron as a beleaguered new mom.
We've seen her drive through the desert in Mad Max with like a truck full of slave women and her arm cut off, and she looked much happier there than she does in this film.
Film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Not, not, notorious, notorious. The notorious RBG, she's been the subject of several books, an animated series, a coloring book, and many a meme, and now a feature documentary. We're going to talk about that. It's Friday, time for movie reviews. Amy Nicholson is host of the podcast The Canon. Welcome back.
Hi.
And Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back.
Hey.
Okay, let's start with RBG. Amy, you saw this one. What'd you think?
I did. I mean, it's definitely a rap anthem to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is for the people who say yes, queen, whenever they say her picture on a coffee mug. It doesn't, I feel like, get very deep into who Ruth Bader Ginsburg is today, but it tells you a lot about her history and her past and her approach to wielding power on the Supreme Court. What I thought was most fascinating is, you know, I pictured her the swaggering, tough girl, and we do see her do push-ups here, but her style of power is very feminine. She listens, she assumes that people aren't mean and don't hate women, they just don't know her perspective.
Yeah.
And she kind of wields them around. And now I understand how she was able to be friends with Scalia.
Right, right. They had this friendship and they were opposites on the court. And there are some really funny moments. We played yesterday one clip when we did the interview with the filmmakers where they had both ridden an elephant on a vacation and they joked around about why she was behind him on the elephant. And she basically said it was a distribution of weight problem.
I can't wait to see this.
I mean, it felt really uplifting watching it just because, A, she's a voice we really need right now, but B, trying to figure out how people can just hear each other, understand each other, and how to actually get change done, how not to just be screaming at each other, but to figure out what on earth can we really do to get laws changed, to really make the lifetime effort that Ruth has made. She's been working her whole life since a young lawyer for female rights.
Yeah.
And that part I found the most moving, even though I felt like at the end of it, there's a lot left unexplored. So it was frustrating to me, yeah, to this film and the final reels.
I was really moved by her marriage.
Yeah, with Marty.
And how supportive her husband was. And I wanted to see more about what it was like for her after he died, because he was so instrumental in her becoming a Supreme Court justice. Because without his lobbying, they would not have considered her as a candidate, the Clinton White House.
Sequel. Exactly. Sequel.
But it's true. The most emotional, I think, she allows herself to get in the film is when you see the old footage of her talking about what Marty did for her by letting her career shine and letting her career take precedence.
Yeah.
That part's beautiful.
All right. Let's move on to now a remake of the 1987 movie starring Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell. It's called Overboard. And this time around, it stars Anna Faris and Eugenio Derbez. Here's a clip.
Could you be a doll and get me a little snack?
You know I was just hired to do carpets, right?
You're fired.
I bet you haven't worked a single day in your entire self-absorbed life. Just pay me and I'll be on my way.
Nope.
No! My equipment!
Okay, so he's throwing her equipment overboard. She is great.
Anna Faris, yeah. Hardworking mom. We love her. She's studying really hard to become a nurse while holding down two jobs with her three adorable daughters.
She ends up on this yacht with this cad.
Right, who has never worked a day in his life. He's going to get a multi-million-dollar company handed to him, and he's horrible to her.
And then somehow he falls overboard and gets amnesia, and then what happens?
Whoops! She decides that she is going to pretend they are married, so that way he can take some of the weight off of her home life, and she can study to be a nurse. It's funny that they had set this movie up with a gender switch to be so different from the original, and it just ends up exactly the same.
Is that a good thing or not?
You know, it's good. It's especially because of the charm of the two actors. Like, I know Anna Faris and her stuff really well and was excited to see her again. And then comes Eugenio Derbez, who I've always really enjoyed in movies like How to Be a Latin Lover. And boy, does he outshine her in this film. I thought it was impossible, and he did it.
And he's really funny.
Well, they're on two completely different comic wavelengths. You know, he's living this comic sitcom style, very muggy style of comedy acting. And Anna Faris is walking into this like it's an indie dramedy. Like, this could be a Sundance right. comedy about a woman just trying her best to get ahead. It is probably smarter to lean more towards his style of comedy. I mean, Eugenio Derbez, he like co-wrote, directed, starred in the most successful Spanish language movie of all time, you know, in 2013, Instructions Not Included. So they're definitely going for that audience, which is kind of great to see. Like, watching this Overboard, it's half in Spanish.
Hmm.
A lot of it is subtitled. And it felt like that moment of, do you remember watching Transformers 3? And there's all the Chinese product placement. And it reminds you that we're making films on such a global level. Like, this film is going to do huge numbers, I bet, in Latin America, even if it seems like a flop here.
Right. I hope that it does well. I mean, it's not going to win against Infinity War's second weekend, but I just enjoyed watching it. I found it easy and very palatable. This isn't great
it's
praise.
It's not mental heavy lifting.
Correct. And so I think that people can go in and just relax and enjoy this one. And with these two actors, I'm fine with it. I'm giving them a pass. I think that, like a lot of the critics at Rotten Tomatoes are saying, it's the same. They didn't do anything with this gender switch, and he's from Mexico, and she's American. But I didn't care. I really didn't. It's because of them.
And I think there is some interesting stuff in the gender switch, because it gets into this idea of he just convinces himself that he's a male who has to provide, and that idea of the weight of going to work at your construction site, talking to his construction buddies about what it means to take care of your wife and how to redefine what a happy life means to you. I thought that stuff was really powerful.
Okay, moving on to a horror thriller movie. It's called Bad Samaritan, which stars Irish actor Robert Sheehan and Scottish former Doctor Who David Tennant. Here's a clip.
Oh, you beauty.
Yo, talk to me.
Black card.
Shut up, Doc, for real.
Yeah.
Everything cool on your end, yeah?
They're just getting their salads now, man.
Just checking here.
Jesus Christ.
Help me, please. I just had a jump scare just there. Oh, wow. Great, what's the plot here?
Okay, so this setup is as simple and elegant as John Wick, okay? So this kid, aspiring photographer, artist, lover, girlfriend, he's in love with, and he's a burglar. And he uses his valet job to get in cars, check people's home address, go rob them of stuff they're not really going to miss.
While they're eating dinner.
Correct. And then nobody's any the wiser.
Wait, which makes me think, does that actually happen?
Yeah. So by the way, everyone listening, do not put your home address in your navigator. That's like 101 stuff. Okay. Uh-huh. So that's a real thing.
I had not even thought about that.
Oh my God. And then you think about how your address is on your car registration. It makes me anxious. So anyway. Yeah, I know, guys. So sorry. I know that this movie gets scarier and scarier. So David Tennant shows up to his restaurant. And he's in, like, this fancy car.
And he's a bad guy. And he's not Doctor Who.
Correct. He's more like Jessica Jones David Tennant and not Doctor Who David Tennant. And he's in the restaurant. The kid goes to his home address. He's like, yes, black card. Hit the jackpot. Oops, there's also a girl locked up in here who can't get out and is flipping out, obviously, begging to be saved.
It's not a 50 Shades of Grey kind of situation.
It is absolutely not, young lady, and I will let us not continue down that path. Because David Tennant's character figures out that the kid knows everything. Cops have shown up to his house, but he's way smart. Comes at this kid with everything he's got. There's nothing else to the film. It's all this is like two guys warring against each other. David Tennant is like chewing scenery. Like I'm sure he didn't eat for the duration of the shooting of the film. No craft services for David. And I loved watching him. I always love watching him. I just felt while I was looking at it, I've seen this a million times before. So ultimately, I didn't
get... Well, yeah, Silence of the Lambs.
Don't Breathe.
Right. So many different ways. And while David Tennant really makes it spectacular, at the end, I was a little underwhelmed. It's pretty violent, but not anything really that surprising inside of it. So I get why. It's just tipped over onto the rotten side of the tomato meter. I get it.
Well, it has made me rethink valeting.
Oh, geez. What world are we living in?
All right. Let's talk now about Tully. This is the third collaboration between Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody of Juno fame. It stars Charlize Theron, Ron Livingston, and Mark Duplass.
No.
Do you know what a night nanny is?
They take care of the baby at night so mom and dad can get some sleep.
I don't want a stranger in my house. It's like a Lifetime movie where the nanny tries to kill the family and the mom survives and she has to walk with a cane at the end.
Get over yourself.
Okay, Amy, you saw this one.
I did, and I was so happy to see this one because it's been 7 years since Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody and Charlize Theron made one of my favorite films, Young Adult, together, a film that I feel like she should have gotten the Oscar for. That movie is amazing, and this movie totally is if that character looked at the person that she least wanted to be and then made a movie about that. Oh. Tully is a woman who's a mother of three. Her husband is not really very helpful. Her children are not the best children. One of them is always on the edge of getting kicked out of their really expensive school, which will just upend her entire life. She's heavily pregnant with her third child at the start of the film. And yet, this is a film about how parents have a hard time telling the truth about parenting, or people maybe have a hard time listening to the truth. You know, she says everything's fine, everything's under control. It's clearly not. And the movie enjoys taking shots at the way that nobody can really talk about parenting honestly.
Mm, interesting. And so Tully is the night nurse that she hires?
Tully is the night nurse that her very rich brother hires for her because he can tell she's on the edge of a nervous breakdown. She had postpartum depression after the birth of her second kid. Everybody's very aware that her mental state is fragile now. And so they hire this night nurse played by Mackenzie Davis, who's just terrific, shows up and is this millennial Mary Poppins. You know, in a minisecond, everything's great. There's cupcakes made. Charlize Theron is sleeping well, and she wakes up and she says, it's like I can see colors in the world again. And so it's about their friendship in a lot of ways, but it's really about just Charlize Theron being the best actress that we have and just giving this role everything she's got. I mean, we've seen her drive through the desert in Mad Max with like a truck full of slave women and her arm cut off, and she looked much happier there than she does in this film.
But I can't say she looks bad, just she doesn't look as beleaguered as probably most moms because she's Charlize Theron.
She does her best. She gained a bunch of weight and wears sweatpants.
Mm. Okay. Meanwhile, where's the dad? Why isn't he helping out?
Yeah, if there is a fault with this movie, it's that they very much lean into the stereotypical dad who's just playing video games and not helping out. Like, he could not be less effectual in this film. And there's some dynamics with that. Like, he wants to leave all the time on work trips. He leaves her alone a lot. But she says everything's fine. And it's really all about her. And so I can imagine watching this movie and being a dad who contributes a lot to the table, too, and feeling like this movie is not fair to you. But it's good to see a mother role get this much of just like a bright spotlight approach where you can just say the meanest thing you've ever thought about being a mom. And this film wants to hear it.
Mm. So is this good for non-moms?
I mean, I'm a non-mom and I loved it. Although I have to say I left and said, I should just keep being a non-mom. Oh, my God.
I'm convinced also. I'm with you, Amy.
Okay. Non-moms who don't valet. That's our lesson for this week. Amy Nicholson is host of the podcast The Canon, Gray Drake, senior movie editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up on the program, a look at how the SAT and the ACT operate and why students have to take those tests despite the fact that they don't really measure intelligence. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Need a pick-me-up? Some good news for a change? How about this? No matter what happens, no matter how badly things go, you will never, ever have to take the SAT again. It's one of the great perks of being a grown-up. And there's a new documentary that reminds us just how horrible the SAT is for the young people who have to take it.
The test doesn't measure what you've learned in school.
Totally different from what you're groomed to know.
It wasn't that I was scared of it. I just knew I wasn't going to do well.
It meant something as though, like, this is the next step in your life. How are you going to get there? I have to kill this test.
There's nothing in this test, nor in the process, that you discover that's going to change you as a person.
Some of the younger people in the movie. It's called The Test and the Art of Thinking. And the filmmaker, Michael Arlen Davis, is here now. Hi.
Greetings. Thank you.
Why did you want to make this movie?
My wife and I, my wife's a filmmaker, name's Jill Johnstone, and we have two daughters. One is 25, one is 20. And it was in the process of watching them go through the test taking that we became very curious about this exam.
And you discovered some interesting history. Tell us about how the SAT, because that was the first one
yes.
that was developed, how that was developed and how it came to be so prevalent.
Social science in the early 20th century was a new field of study. And the notion of IQ, intelligence quotient, was a new tool that was developed that emerged out of the field of social science. And principally, the president of Harvard, James Ryan Conant, wished to use this tool to help people with academic talent who didn't have the background that would normally provide them an opportunity to have higher education. So it was, there was, as Nicholas Lemon, who's written, I think, probably the most important textbook on this subject, points out in the film, it was something of a utopian idea, a very idealistic idea, that we could find help people who didn't have opportunity through this mechanism.
The person who had this social vision was James Bryant Conant, the president of Harvard. If you're in the top 0.1% and you have the kind of mind and the kind of skills that show up on an SAT, the system will find you. You will not spend your life walking behind a mule and a plow. You'll go to a fancy college on scholarship. That's done. That's a check mark.
So they would take the test if they were perhaps not going to good schools or getting this kind of elite education. They could show people, oh, no, we are. I'm actually smart. You should accept me to college.
Yes. That was the initial idea.
And then how did it become something completely different?
Well, you know, this happens. It's, you know, it's not uncommon that, and again, Nicholas Lemon points this out in the film, it's not uncommon that an ideal, when it becomes a practical reality, other forces intervene, maybe commercial forces intervene, and it becomes something other than it was intended.
Well, speaking of, there is an army, an industry of test prep people who are hired to help kids do well on these tests. And you have many of them in your film. They're quite an eccentric group, some of them.
That was a discovery for us. I think that was a really interesting discovery.
My job is to regulate the amount of fear. I'm evaluating them, not the test, not anything else. I'm evaluating what I think they can and can't do.
Show me 300. Move your pen.
Oh, I just realized that's the degree of the...
Now keep going.
Okay.
My own opinion is that those tutors know the test better than anyone, better than the people who make the test, because they deal with students day in, day out in real time. The good ones are like Sherpas, in my view. They're guides. They're helping students. And a good one to me is one who is helping a student not be damaged by the process, or I would describe them as being non-invasive.
And they help them get a better score.
They help
right?
them get a better score.
Not necessarily by teaching them anything substantive, anything about the subject matter, but teaching them how to game the test.
In fact, I mean, I think that becomes very, very obvious, you know, throughout the film, and I think people know that. You know, for decades, the College Board said that you couldn't prepare for the test until companies like Princeton Review and Kaplan demonstrated you could prepare for the test, because they had this notion that this was this IQ-type test, and therefore you couldn't prepare for it. So when the test prep companies discovered, in fact, you could get inside the test, learn its code. It is a code, in my opinion, and you could decode it, and then you could help students prepare for it. Now, the College Board itself is in the business of prepping kids.
So it's basically admitting that the test isn't really testing anything beyond being able to take the test.
Well, I don't think they would actually state that. It's very rare. I mean, if you follow the history, the College Board's not going to acknowledge that. That isn't going to happen.
But I mean, unacknowledged admission that this is a game in a way, that this is not something that's actually measuring your innate abilities.
Well, that's certainly, I think, young people would say, most young people you would meet would acknowledge that. I mean, that there's many, many references in the film to professionals and parents talking about gaming, about it's like a video game, very much like a video game.
There's also an interesting scene where another tutor actually takes the question away, a math
yes.
problem, and then guides the student to figure out the answer just by looking at the pattern of
the answers,
the multiple choice answers.
No question, right.
Which is extraordinary. So you don't even have to read the question to get the answer right.
So here's the first rule. Look for patterns of three and eliminate the oddballs. Choose the choice closest to the middle.
Black magic.
That's what he calls it.
In black magic.
Okay, well, it's that season where kids are taking their tests now and getting their results.
This Saturday, there's a test, SAT test.
There's an SAT test, yeah. So it doesn't seem like it's going away.
I think quite the opposite. You know, we indicate at the end of the film that for various reasons, it looks like the SAT and the ACT are actually seeping deeper and deeper into the educational system. And we raise this concern, and I think it's underneath the entire film, which is to what extent is school beginning to mimic test prep. Test prep is not school. That the SAT and the ACT were created to assess what goes on in school. They were not created to be what goes on in school. And yet, for convenience sake, it appears that more and more they're playing a role in that regard.
Filmmaker Michael Arlen Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The movie is called The Test in the Art of Thinking. There's a screening and a Q&A tonight at the Lemley Music Hall Theater. You're listening to member-supported KCRW Santa Monica, Los Angeles, KDRW Santa Barbara, KCRI Indio, Palm Springs, KCRU Oxnard, Ventura, and KCRY Mojave, a community service of Santa Monica College and NPR for Southern California. Our show is produced by Sarah Sweeney, Amy Ta, Christian Bordahl, Michelle Aloy, Gina Pollack, and Yael Evan Orr. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra is our engineer. Alexandra Trigvadottir is our intern. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.